Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 175 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
We here at the Outlander podcast are absolutely thrilled to welcome Scottish writer Maggie Craig to our show, the first of, I hope, not the last appearance or audio appearance. And beyond the welcome, how are you this morning, Maggie?
Well, I'm absolutely fine. Of course, it's afternoon here in Scotland, and it's what we would call gaidrich, which means very dull and dreary. But apart from that, I'm absolutely delighted to be on the podcast.
Well, thank you. And as I said, we're delighted to have you. Now, I've already introduced you as a writer, so that's kind of, and we're here to talk about one of your books. But before we get into that, tell us a little bit about yourself, your upbringing, your background, your training. What can you tell our listeners about yourself?
I grew up in Glasgow on the west coast of Scotland. I now live in Aberdeenshire, which is where my mother came from. But I grew up in Glasgow, or more precisely Clydebank, where we're very proud of all the great ships that were built at Clydebank, the Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Elizabeth II, the Queen Mary, the Queen Mary II. My dad was from Lanarkshire, south of Glasgow. My mother, as I said, from Aberdeenshire. They were great storytellers, so that's in the blood, really. Grew up in Glasgow, went and did a secretarial course, because that's what you did, because you always had something to fall back on if you had a secretarial course. And then decided I wanted to go and study languages. So I studied languages in London, German and Spanish, specialising in translating. And then later worked for about 15 years as a Blue Badge Scottish Tours Guide, which was great for honing the storytelling skills, of course.
Oh my goodness, just right there, we could have a whole other episode or three. I'm also a German linguist and was trained or have spoken German for now more than half of my life. So I find that fascinating also as a non-native speaker. What made you choose German?
I had a friend when I was young. Well, she's still my best friend. We've been best friends for a long, long time. And her mum was German. And I think it was the idea that at an early age, I was introduced to the fact that people spoke different languages. And also because, as I said, my dad was from Lanarkshire, which had a sort of its own dialect of Scots. And my mother was from Aberdeenshire, which has a very distinctive dialect of Scots called Doric. If you're not a native Doric speaker, you might be completely confused when someone speaks to you. It also gave me this idea that there was different ways of saying things. So I've always been fascinated by languages and dialects.
And you're right. What an interesting stepping stone along the path to your destiny as a writer. And then when you said you were a Blue Badge tour guide, oh my goodness, not just, you probably already knew, having parents from different coasts and different parts of Scotland, you probably already knew a lot about the geography, but as a tour guide, you probably became quite the expert. Beyond the storytelling, you became an expert. That was your job.
Well, that was the job. That was the job, to know about Scotland and to represent it to other people. My father was a railwayman, which meant that we got reduced fares, privileged tickets, it was called, and free passes every year. So we went all over Scotland on the train when I was young. There were four of us, my brother and three girls altogether. And he knew the story behind every stone, and he told us the story behind every stone. And then when I became a tourist guide, well, of course, you had to have that knowledge, and you also had to have the more precise knowledge about what people earned and the history in more detail and so on. But I think really in Scotland, people know their history quite well. So although sometimes, you know, when you study it in an academic way, you realise that history is complicated and history has shades of grey. So that was interesting as well. And of course, as a tourist guide, you're an ambassador for Scotland. I mainly worked with German visitors or German speaking visitors, and they were fantastic because they were so interested in Scottish history. And they asked you everything, like what sort of fish would there be in this river? And so I had to learn all of that as well. And how much would it cost to fish in this river? That sort of thing. And they all know, the Germans all know if they know nothing, they know Mary Queen of Scots, whom they call Maria Stuart. So everything had to be related to her. So that was interesting. It was all about making connections.
Absolutely. As soon as you said Maria Stuart, that brought to me a yes, I read that play, the Schiller play as well. part of a German degree. And also about not so much German, but Germans. I have found, and granted, I am probably not uniquely placed, but probably biased toward this or for this, because once you know something or are predisposed to it, that's kind of what you see.
Yes.
So I imagine there are other cultures or other countries who also have a fascination with Scottish Celtic stuff, if you will.
Yes.
History, language, travel. But in my experience, the Germans, and I mean this in a positive way, are rabid for Scotland.
Absolutely. And I first realized this. Now, before Outlander, there was Highlander, the movie. And I first realized this when I went to Ealandonan Castle. I thought, what are all these Germans doing here? Why are they so interested in this? And then I realized why all those Germans were there and why Germans on my tours always wanted to go to Ealandonan. My theory is that the Germans have... Well, there's a bit of a difficulty with 20th century German history because you have to go through a difficult period. But I think it's romanticism. I don't know what you think, having studied this as well. It comes from the romantic period and Mendelssohn and the Scottish Symphony and the wildness of Scotland. And there's something in the German soul that just relates to that.
I definitely, especially, yeah, as soon as you said that, I can see that with the romantic spirit and Wagner and just the drama. And obviously Wagner was much more toward the Norse.
Yes.
But still, that whole age, I can absolutely see that.
And I took Germans to Culloden. And you take them round and you try and give a balanced picture, but you also try and give the picture of what actually happened on that field. And it wasn't unusual for the Germans to have tears in their eyes. And I remember one man saying to me, you make it sound as though it happened yesterday. I said, well, for us in Scotland, it did. We have long memories. So Culloden did just happen yesterday. And we know the names of so many people who were on that field. So it's really something that's deep in our souls. And the Germans really got that.
Speaking of Culloden, I get that's a very good link into what we're actually here to speak of today. But before we get to your book that we're here specifically to speak about, Damn Rebel Bitches, given that unique path and with the background of your family's storytelling, was it a natural path for you to go into that? Number one, writing. And number two, you don't just write fiction, right? You write nonfiction. Was that a natural path, or did you make a conscious decision to do both?
Absolutely natural. One of the other family stories is that we are descended from Robert Tannehill, who was a poet in Paisley. Although I have to say my poetry is absolutely terrible. That's one thing I'm no good at. I started writing nonfiction because things would just spark off something in my head, and I would think that would make an interesting article. And I wrote quite a few articles about the Jacobites because that's always been a passion. My dad took me to Culloden when I was about 10 years old, and that's where that started from. And then I thought in 1995, when everyone was talking about the 250th anniversary, and I knew that there had been a lot of women involved in the Jacobite cause. And I said to my husband, somebody ought to write a book about that. And he said, well, why don't you write the book about it? So that's where it came from. But before that, I had been writing fiction about the Jacobite period. There is a book which has not yet seen the light of day, and there is one book published about that period. So it was really the research for the fiction that sparked off the nonfiction.
Has it ever worked the other way around as well? In your research about the history, have you ever been inspired to write a fiction story?
Oh, yes, because that's what's actually happened with a lot of the people, because I've written two books, non-fiction books, about the men, the women, and then about the men. And quite a few of them are in my fiction. I'm writing my third Jacobite fiction, and I like to have the two central characters to be fictional, but the characters around them to be real. And things spark off. Like, I am absolutely in love with this man called Duncan Forbes of Culloden, who was against Bonnie Prince Charlie and whose house was at Culloden. And he hated tea, and I love tea. And he spoke about tea as a vile drug and a contemptible beverage. And as soon as you get that real strong character coming through, you think, I have to put you in a book. And he is in a book.
I actually have questions about the tea as well.
Oh, yes.
So, okay, to now our pièce de résistance, the damn rebel bitches, the women of the 45. What more apt discussion than to bring in the author of this book? Because you'll not find another book, I don't think, about the women of the 45.
Nope, this is the only book about the women of the 45.
I found it fascinating because I had read it in, I did go to school. I went to uni only 1 year. I did a postgraduate degree in University of St. Andrews. And I studied a history, but it was early medieval Scottish history. But reading about the dates was fascinating because I forgot that it was actually that recent that the calendars changed or the calendars were agreed. So explain to our readers why we actually don't celebrate Culloden on the date it actually occurred.
Well, this is because there was a difficulty with the calendar. The calendar had to be adjusted because to do with very complicated things about the time it takes the Earth to orbit and so on. And the problem was that there was the Julian calendar, which had started in Roman times. And then Pope Gregory, in I think about 1600s or maybe slightly earlier, had commissioned two Jesuit priests to make up another calendar, which is the modern Gregorian calendar. But the trouble was that because Europe was split between Protestants and Catholics, the Protestant countries didn't really want to adopt the calendar, but they had to. And what happened was that they got to a sort of mishmash. And if you look at original documents, original papers, you'll see old style and new style dating. I was told, I got onto this because I was told by an old lady in Inverness, well, you go on the 16th of April. We always went on the 27th of April because there was a discrepancy of 11 days. So as far as she was concerned, you should be commemorating Culloden on the 27th of April. And in some parts of Scotland, they still celebrate Old New Year. Near where I live at a place called Burghead, which is along the Murray coast from Inverness, they celebrate Old New Year on the 11th of January. So that there's still a bit of lingering on. And when they changed over the calendar in 1752, when they made it uniform throughout the British Isles, people rioted in the streets saying, give us back our 11 days. And I just love that. The idea that people felt they had lost 11 days out of their lives.
I know. I couldn't imagine. You'd imagine if this were still going on today. Oh, there would be riots.
Well, what would happen with computers and all the digital
business we've got? The world almost ended or not during Y2K. I couldn't imagine 11 days, let alone like a 1 second delay.
It can make it a bit confusing because it gives Bonnie Prince Charlie two birthdays, you know, like the 20th of December and the 31st of December.
Well, it gives us all two birthdays, except that we weren't alive then.
Yes. But trying to get your head around it can be difficult because maths and arithmetic is not my strong suit. Am I going the right way with these 11 days? I'm not entirely sure.
Well, once you get past that and you lay out the, not the argument, but you lay out the matter of the date and say it is accepted because that's what you find in history books, of course, so that's what's used. You go with what is used. Then the reader can kind of forget about it and say, okay, great, that's interesting. Yeah. If I want to investigate more, I can. But for now, I have to go with a date so I don't lose my head the rest of this book.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So something that also struck me was the presumed danger, as you mentioned earlier, of tea. Proper ladies drank claret and the like, and tea, it seemed, was literally a device you were able to thread throughout the entire book as representational of the threat of Jacobitism.
Well, I'm glad you liked that.
I thought it was interesting, and I thought, oh, that's fascinating. And then I didn't know it would keep coming up, and I just love that you kept bringing it up. And seeing how dangerous a device tea would be later in the American colonies, about 30 years later, it makes sense. So why was tea considered so dangerous?
It was a foreign import. They didn't really like the idea of people drinking foreign drinks, even though a lot of it was coming from India, which Britain was busily colonizing at the time. But tea was expensive. It was very fashionable. It had tax on it. And a lot of tea was being smuggled. And that was one thing that people like Duncan Forbes didn't like, that people weren't paying duty on the tea. And he also thought it was a bit effete. It was a bit weakening. You know, why weren't you drinking ale? That's what you should be drinking, or claret. So, and I think also my thesis is that women in particular, women love tea, and women were sitting around talking to each other. And what was worse, it wasn't just elite women, wasn't just the higher class women. Maidservants were beginning to sit around drinking tea. And I think men felt that their authority was being challenged because women were sitting around talking about them. And maybe not adhere. What is it they call it in the movies? Is it the Bechdel test? When if two women are having a conversation that's not about a man. So I think they were probably worried that women were having conversations not about men, and maybe having conversations also about men and about politics and so on. So I think it was the social aspect of people getting together with tea. And also because Duncan Forbes was just, he was a traditionalist, and you should have your warm ale. That would be much better for you. People didn't particularly like to drink water, but water wasn't as clean as it is for those of us in Western countries now. So there was a sort of medicinal idea about drinking ale. But then, of course, some people claimed that for tea as well.
You also discuss some of the different views on women had by the Jacobites and the Hanoverians.
Yes.
One of the things I found interesting was that Scottish, this is not a view of women, but this is something that women were able to do. Scottish women were legally allowed to retain their own names after marriage.
Yes.
And 18th century women had in some ways more freedom than their Victorian counterparts. So all of this, why do you think these were potentially so different? Why is it so intriguing, this 18th century status or place of women?
I think it's intriguing because I think the Victorians succeeded. And to me, women in Victorian times, certainly in this country, had very restricted lives or found it more difficult to break out of what was considered to be the way they should live. And somehow in the 18th century, it's the age of reason, isn't it? We're at that period between the late Middle Ages and the early modern times. So people are starting to think, and they're starting to think that maybe everything could be challenged. There's a woman I quoted in my book who was a writer who said, "Why do they call us silly women and not try to make us otherwise?" People were even talking about maybe women could go to the universities, even in the 1740s. And Scotland was a birthplace of the Enlightenment. The ideas were all bubbling up around about the 1740s. So the idea that women and men might be able to converse as equals was a strong one, and it was coming up. When I wrote this book, people would say to me, "But how could women have been involved? They didn't even have the vote." And my response to that was, most men didn't have the vote. That wasn't how society worked in those days. So there were a lot of powerful women. And I also found a lot of women working outside the home. So that was interesting.
What were some of the other fascinating trends of the time besides the naughty garter? Can you explain to our listeners about this fashion in particular and maybe some other Jacobite fashions?
Well, the naughty garter, one of it had sort of said, you know, basically the 18th century equivalent of don't go any further. it became something that they would embroider the slogans of the campaign, like prosperity to Scotland and no union and these sort of things. So there was a lot of gallantry going on in Jacobite times. And of course, one of the big things is the white cockade, or a lot of Scots will insist that should be the white cockade, the way you should pronounce it, which was the Jacobite emblem, which came from the little white rose of Scotland, which is the dog rose or the briar rose. And people sewed that with white ribbon, either four or five petals, and that was worn as a cap badge, and people wore it on dresses as well. And white ribbons became very identified with the Jacobites, so that if a woman was wearing white ribbons, it was a tacit signal that she was sympathetic towards the Jacobites. And one of the lovely things, you know, there's a great controversy about tartan and the origins of tartan, but certainly tartan was a sign that you were sympathetic to the Jacobites. And there's a lovely story about the raid on tartan dresses in Edinburgh in 1746 after the defeat at Culloden. And a redcoat officer was ordered to apprehend any ladies wearing tartan and white cockades. And he just burst out laughing and treated the whole thing as a joke and didn't arrest anybody, but went through the motions.
We know that people, women, but men as well, but people have been expressing themselves through fashion for eternity.
Yes.
But to read about the different things, like, of course, the cockade, of course, the rose are heavily linked or literally linked to Bonnie Prince Charlie. But these other forms of some, not subterfuge, but okay, a garter, of course, would be beneath.
Yes.
Would not be seen as you're walking down the street. So it's a way of almost subversively sticking it to the man, if you will.
It's not wearing a big lapel pin.
Exactly. So they had all kinds of ways to express their loyalties. I find that fascinating.
Yes. Yes, I suppose we do it today, though. I mean, we do it in ribbons, don't we? We do it in ribbons to support AIDS charities or cancer charities or whatever. So they were doing it too. They wanted to show what their sympathies were, but it was much more dangerous then, because showing that sympathy could even get you shot, possibly, once hostilities had started. But people very strongly wanted to say that this is what I'm doing, this is who we are. And it was in, I'm not an expert on this by any means, but it came over into things like Jacobite glasses, drinking glasses, and also, you know, this idea that you would toast the king over the water, meaning the Stuarts. So if you were a hostess, you would have some bowls of water on the table so people could just go to the king and just push their glass over the water, and that meant they were toasting King James and not King George. I think it was almost before it all got violent and hostility started, it was almost a game. It was almost like, what is it you call it on the internet? Virtue signalling. It was a kind of 18th century version of virtue signalling. But then it became really serious. And if you had a portrait or a miniature of Bonnie Prince Charlie, you probably had to go and hide it when things got rough.
Regarding the garter specifically, or things such as that, I totally see what you're saying as far as we still show our loyalty with different things in our different fashion expressions, or we show our loyalty, or we show beliefs, or we show things that we support through things that we wear. We can.
Yes.
I can't think of anything currently that we do, at least that we talk about, that we do subversively, like a garter.
No, because most of us don't wear garters anymore. I'm trying to think of a modern equivalent.
But something like, even like on your underwear, something that's not out on the outside is what I'm saying.
No, I don't think we do. But then we I suppose we feel freer to express our views and our opinions, freer than people did back then, possibly. Or we don't have to be quite so careful, perhaps.
Most definitely.
Yeah.
In your chapter on Jenny Cameron, you write, quote, "That she brought the men to Glenfinnan is not in doubt, nor that she was devoted to the prince and his cause. The price she paid for that was a savage attack on her reputation and morals. It is only now that those are being reclaimed," unquote. It's sad to have to state that this way of attacking a female is still well and alive in the 21st century.
Absolutely.
What effects did these attacks have on her character and her place in history, which is still, as you're saying, being rectified?
I think people who know a bit about it, people don't know so much about her. There is a lovely old folk song about her. People don't know so much about her, but people who do will say, oh, she was Charlie's mistress, wasn't she? And it's as though it's just something casual that you don't need to be bothered about. I find that quite sad. As you say, it's still a modern form of attack. And if you say, it's even worse now with the internet, isn't it? Mm. But if you say a woman has bad morals, whatever bad morals are now considered to be, you discount her in other ways, which perhaps doesn't happen quite so much with men. I think we still have that attitude that a man's a bit of a lad, as we would say in this country, but a woman who's supposedly had lots of affairs or has had a very high profile affair can be just discounted and sort of brushed aside. I think that was the big effect it had on Jenny Cameron. And, you know, she ended up having a pleasant a later life, but people still would discount her.
You also offered some more amusing accounts. In your chapter, Whither Thou Goest, You describe how a Gaelic-speaking Highlander entered the home of a Mrs. Hewitt and her daughter.
Yes.
And hilarity ensued. Can you briefly describe what I'm talking about? I found this, I don't want to say sweet because that's making light of it, but when those women were probably scared out of their heads.
Well, this was when the Highland army, the Jacobite army, went south into England because Bonnie Prince Charlie wanted to head for London. So, of course, one of the first places that you come over the border in England is Carlisle. And the soldiers were billeted on the townsfolk, who didn't have much choice. It was, you know, here's your Highlander kind of thing. And these ladies were alone in the house and they were terrified that he was going to dispatch them. And there also had been stories spread that Highlanders liked nothing more than to eat children. So they were worried about this as well. So to try and allay their fears, he stuck his ski and do into the table, which when you think about it, if you were terrified, if you were two women alone in a house and a man came in and stuck this great big knife in the middle of the kitchen table, you would think, oh, no, it's going to be us next. And then he danced around the kitchen doing a sort of Highland fling to say, look, I'm dancing. But if you think, I don't know if you've seen a Highland fling, but it's quite a dramatic sort of dance.
Yes.
So it took him a long time to calm them down.
I'm just trying to think about those poor women. I know it's not, their side is not funny, but I'm just trying to think, besides being having all of these preconceived notions because of what the propaganda was, and besides, of course, their worst fears come to life. He takes the knife and like shoves it in the table. I mean, how does that not confirm what they've been told?
Absolutely. And they didn't have a language in common. They spoke English.
Exactly.
So there was. He must have sounded as though he was saying, making the most awful threats, and he was probably saying, "Calm down, ladies. I come in peace. I mean you no harm." So,
but then he starts to dance, yes, which is just icing on the cake. I mean,
I just think he must have thought, "Oh no, what can I do now? How can I calm these women down?" I'll dance.
And then I'm surprised. I wonder if they like one of them like just fainted. I mean,
in the 18th century people were prone to swoon. So imagine
swooning, yes.
One of them might have swooned into the arms of the other.
Well, something I'd not thought of much before was just how busy and stressed the prince. Well, everyone was, obviously, but the prince especially during 45 and 46, and how unlikely it would have been that he would have had many, if any, romantic dalliances. When you point it out that way, it's very logical. You know, all these women being accused, or the prince being accused of having had a dalliance over here and a dalliance over there. Well, he had a lot on his mind.
Well, you know the expression, I met myself on the way back. I think he was doing that because he was having to speak to everybody. So, yes, there was just the one affair, I think, when he was in Scotland. And that was with Clementine Walkinshaw at Bannockburn House. Now, this is really exciting. Bannockburn House still exists near the city of Stirling. And many of us, myself included, have passed Bannockburn House near the motorway services station and not realised it was there because it's been empty for 40 years. It's like the Sleeping Beauty's castle. And a local group are trying to revive it. And I was invited to go there back in September. And you can go to the room where Bonnie Prince Charlie slept and possibly where Clementine Walkinshaw and he became lovers. And everyone's terribly excited about this. The house is needing some tender, loving care. And that's being given to it now. So that's bringing back the story of Bonnie Prince Charlie and Clementine Walkinshaw.
Oh, that's fascinating. There were also women who were, as you put it, true angels of mercy. They went out to Dromasi Moor and did what they could to aid the wounded and the dying. Did it surprise you that women went out even at this, perhaps the most dangerous time, to that battlefield?
It humbled me to think how brave they were, because they knew at that time that soldiers can be brutal after a success, after a victory. So they were going out and they were really risking being raped, they were risking being killed. And I gave Damn Rebel Bitches the working title of Not Flora MacDonald. Not because I don't like Flora MacDonald, but because my heroine is Anne Leith, who was the woman who instigated, she got a friend and the friend's maid together. I hope they said to the maid, you don't have to do this. But they went out, and you know it's about 4 miles from Inverness out to Drumossie, and they took out bandages and water and something to eat, I presume, as much as they could carry in their baskets. I think they're astonishing, and I want to know why there's not a statue of Anne Leith in Scotland. Mm.
Oh my gosh, that actually would be quite fitting there at the, maybe not on the moor, but near the visitor centre.
I think it would be, yes.
So of course there's Flora MacDonald. She is fascinating to read about and to understand, on my part at least, that she really was accepted by all, and that means by both sides, as a heroine because she accepted her duty and she didn't fight for the cause. She was there after the fact and she did assist the prince, but she didn't fight. She wasn't actively trying to be part of something before the final battle. And it's an interesting juxtaposition, her against the other women. And it's interesting, and this is nothing against her at all, but in looking at the society, even today, a woman is much more easily accepted, even by the other side, if she is maybe young, or if she is meek, if she is mild, if she is doing something she's asked to do rather than fighting for something she believes in.
Do you know, that's really interesting what you just said there, if she's doing something that she was asked to do. Because an awful lot of women, myself included, tend to say yes rather than no when someone asks them to do something. Hasn't that always been the case? Before I did this interview with you, I reread Damn Rebel Bitches and I thought, have I been hard on Flora? And it's difficult to get to Flora to find out what she was really about. I think in some ways she had quite a sheltered life. In other ways, not, because she was, you know, she was out in the countryside and helping look after the sheep and all that sort of thing. But my take on it was that, what you've just described there, that because she didn't answer back, she didn't try she helped the rebel in chief, but her womanly heart was touched. And there's nothing wrong with that. And what she did coming over on the Minch and travelling with this, they called him a muckle great trollop when he was dressed in woman's dress because he was quite tall.
Wasn't that Betty Burke?
That was Betty Burke, yeah. It was risky. It was risky what she was doing. Funnily enough, the local paper had a photograph this week of the unveiling of Flora's statue, which you've probably seen in front of Inverness Castle, which is a beautiful statue, which was unveiled in 1899. I think, yes, that's fantastic, but where are some of these other women? Where's Anne Leith and where's Colonel Anne? But Colonel Anne had gone out and raised the men, so she'd done something which people at the time thought was unwomanly. So I think there was, Flora's maybe got there because she adhered to the traditional gender role. It's something to do with that. It's very romantic, and people try to make a romance between her and Charlie because that's also like, is that the only way you can understand that men and women relate to each other? And that annoys me a bit as well. But I wrote Damn Rebel Bitches. Next year will be the 20th anniversary. But you look at descriptions of the Jacobites and you can bet your bottom dollar the only woman who'll be mentioned is Flora MacDonald. I do my bit to try and get these other women out there, but people still adhere to Flora. People maybe like their history light, or they like their history simple, but history doesn't work that way, as we know.
They like their history that doesn't challenge them,
yes. That
doesn't unsettle them.
Yes. And also, we're not going to discuss this now because we don't have time, it's not appropriate, but if you start to relate it to what's happening in modern times, people don't like it.
Absolutely not a commentary on Flora MacDonald as far as what she did or didn't do. Well, what she did, absolutely not. And she had a hard time later on, too. As you said, she didn't have the greatest marriage. She was ill when she came back to Scotland before she died, right?
Yes.
And so she didn't have truly a happily ever after. She was...
She didn't have a great life. And it's, you know, there's a couple of paintings of her and she looks lovely, you know, with her lovely clothes and her white roses and everything. I think she's rather a sad figure. I'm hoping to visit North Carolina next year. So I hope I can seek out where Flora lived for quite a number of years before coming back to Scotland. It's amazing to me that people went across the Atlantic, lived there for several years and then came back again. It seems such an effort in those times.
I knew she had come over, but I didn't know that she had gone back. And I found that fascinating that she talked about an undertaking.
They must have been horribly homesick. That's the only reason I can think of for going back.
The Whitehaven Three, yes. The trio of women, was an exciting read. Can you share briefly with listeners what this was about and the mystery that exists even to today?
Well, there were several women went with the Jacobite army when they went into England, because women went as camp followers. And some women were captured as the Jacobites retreated and went back into Scotland. And there were three women who were taken to Whitehaven, which is a town on the coast at the very northwest of England. And they were imprisoned there. However, it would appear that they managed to escape. And nobody's quite sure how they managed to do this. And I went to Whitehaven to research this. I love the research and I love going to do the research on the ground. And to find out, when I told people there what I was doing, and I said that, you know, these women had tunnelled their way out of this house of correction, which was a small jail, the people in Whitehaven, the people I spoke to in Whitehaven said, and did they get away okay? They were concerned that these three women had managed to escape. But what happened to them after that, we don't know. There were Jane, Margaret and Anne. So whether they were probably wives or maybe widows of Jacobite soldiers at that time. But it seemed like a little victory that three of them had managed to get away and escape and hadn't been transported to the West Indies, as many women were.
Yeah, I find it not romantic in a Flora MacDonald way, but almost that mystery almost has its own intrigue and romance to it.
Yes, it does. Yeah. I sort of wondered if the woman who was the wife of the jailer had helped them, had been touched by their plight and thought they're so far from home, what's the point of keeping them in prison here? And I wondered if she'd maybe helped them on their way. I think you could write a good play about this, or maybe a novella about the escape of the Whitehaven Three, because people were whipped up to be enemies, you know, Scottish and English and Highland and Lowland. Mm-hmm. But human nature being what it is, people were sympathetic for people they felt were in a terrible situation.
And you actually just gave a wonderful segue to my next question, that in the end, after Culloden and after the backlash throughout the Highlands and Northern England, as more and more people were brought to trial and hung and just executed, Londoners, Englanders, the English became sick of it. It grew past, okay, we get it. And I found that fascinating to read about.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, we throughout Britain, we no longer have the death penalty, which was abolished in about the 1960s. Apart from treason, you can still be executed for treason, which is an interesting one, but that hasn't happened since probably the First World War. I think I hesitate to say the English and the Scots, but the English, I think, are a nation of people who can be who will recognise somebody as the enemy, but then as soon as that enemy becomes the underdog, they start to have sympathy. And also because the method of execution in those days was still barbaric. It's always barbaric, but being hung, drawn and quartered. So, and people witnessed that. So people were disgusted by it. There's a lady in Carlisle who saw people being hanged, and she said it haunted her fancy for half a century. And you think that must have been every night before she went to sleep, and when she woke up in the morning, she must have seen this horrible scene, and that affected a lot of people. And they were seeing it as not, it wasn't like people being killed on the battlefield, it was murder, really. They were seeing it as judicial murder, and they were horrified by it.
Yeah, these people were already incarcerated and they were no longer campaigning.
There were no danger, they didn't have weapons, there were no threat to the crown. It was revenge, really. And I think people, can I say ordinary people? Ordinary people didn't like the idea of revenge. It went too far.
Reading about Culloden in general can turn your stomach, yes. Because not just because of the actual acts, the battle and you know things and gruesomeness, but just the fatality of it and the you know, looking back, obviously hindsight 2020, not even 2020, excuse me. We read it from a very comfortable place. And it's very easy to feel sad or to feel sympathy for people who were involved or the families of those affected. So almost 270 years later, it's very easy to look back and have a very pretty sympathy.
Yes.
And even if you go to the battlefield and you're, as many people as I have been, and moved to tears by the reality of what you are standing on. But if I get past that, you know, oh, that's so sad, or oh, that's, you know what I'm saying? It's, if I spend too much time lingering in that, it becomes overwhelming.
It becomes overwhelming. I don't like sentimentality. I don't like sentimentality that attaches to this, because there's some definition of sentimentality, which is emotion without having had to suffer for it. And I sometimes feel that. And in general, most of us are not, for example, exposed to the wilds of the weather. If you think about, because we get into cars or we go on trains or planes or whatever. If you think, for example, about Anne Leith and Mrs. Stoner and Eppie going out to Culloden, it was cold at Culloden. It was sleeting. And they were going out through cold weather. So there's that as well. There's that being absolutely frozen and not sure where you are. So it can be overwhelming. And I'm not sure what you do with the emotion of that. Some people feel it, but in a way it's wonderful that people still feel it. At Culloden a couple of years ago, I heard a young father saying to his two, a young Scottish father saying to his two children, "Behave yourself, people died here." And I thought that was lovely that it was still being remembered and still being felt.
I have not had the opportunity to visit there yet, but I would imagine it would be a similar situation, if you will, to visit Gettysburg.
Well, I would like to visit Gettysburg when I come to the States, because I think it's one of those places that that you feel history and you feel the people who stood there.
I need to go revisit a picture because I can't I cannot tell you where it was or the date, although I can tell you the year. So I was an exchange student a number of times. And one summer I was an exchange worker. I did a program through my university, an extension, and I went to Switzerland for a year. And we won't talk about how I learned Hochdeutsch and didn't have one word of dialect and like almost cried the first week.
I lived in Switzerland for 2 years. I know your pain. I had that pain.
And I mean, Switzerland, other than Scotland, Switzerland is my favorite place on earth, I think. So beautiful. I worked there for a summer, and my host family, they didn't have any kids, so they're pretty young, and they took me around to different, you know, different places. They wanted to show me some culture, show me some of the countryside. And we stopped at some place. We didn't stop for a purpose to look at something. We stopped to get a drink or to get petrol or something. I'm not sure. But I got out of the car and the station was near this huge open field. And there was like a commemorative stone or obelisk. And I went up to read about it. And no, I am not joking. It said, this commemorates this certain battle that happened on this field in this year, blah, blah, blah. And it was the date of the battle was the date we had stopped there. And I thought, and granted, I'm not making any kind of comparisons, but you get this feeling of a chill running down your back. You know, you get this really, even if you have no idea, yes. And I couldn't even tell you again the date or the location other than that it was in Switzerland. But you get anything like that is like almost all cultures can respect that in a way of another culture. It's hallowed ground.
Yes, absolutely. And Culloden, as you'll know, is very much hallowed ground. It's a very special place.
Out of all of the people that you were researching as you prepped to write this book, who was the most fun to research and write about?
Oh, the most fun. I think she was Molly. She was the barmaid at Blair Athol.
Oh.
When Blair Castle was being...
The one who went back and forth.
And there was sort of a lowland group of redcoats in the castle. And Lord George Murray, who was the son of the house, was besieging his own brother's house and said to his brother, "I hope you won't mind if we make a bit of a mess of it," kind of thing. And his brother said, "Well, it'll be a pity to lose the family portraits." And you can imagine that being said very sarcastically. But they needed a messenger. But the guy in the castle had the reputation of shooting first and asking questions later. So Molly, the barmaid, said, "I'll go," because the young redcoat officers had been staying at the inn before they retreated to the castle. So she kind of sashays up to to Blair Castle, and I can just see her doing it. You know, a barmaid has to have a smart mouth on her. And when she got there, she shouted, the young officers were leaning out of the window, and she said, if you surrender, they'll treat you well, they won't kill you, they won't hurt you. And it said that her the young officers responded to her with juvenile mirth. So I think there must have been a lot of banter going backwards and forwards. So she was a bit of light relief in the midst of it all.
And what was the biggest surprise you had doing your research?
Oh, a surprise. I'm not sure if there was a big surprise, really. I had kind of known. Well, actually, there is a surprise, because the Jacobite story, as I've said in the book, has tended to be written by the losers and not by the winners, contrary to what happens normally in history. So we all know about the Highlands and everything, but it was to find out there was more Jacobites in the Lowlands, and there were a lot of Jacobites in Aberdeenshire, in northeast Scotland, because people in northeast Scotland are, even today, are quite reticent sort of people. So you don't really find out about that, and then you scratch the surface and you find out there were loads of Jacobites in that part. So it was more, I don't see it as a Highlands Lowlands thing so much. You know, that's quite often given as the Highlanders and then the Lowlanders with the redcoats. I don't see it that way anymore. So that was a surprise.
You also wrote a book about the men of the 45. Tell us briefly about that.
Well, my son said to me, you've written a book about the women, I think, for gender balance, you should write a book about the men, with his tongue firmly in his cheek. So I wrote this book, which is called Der Arse Banditti, which is slightly vulgar in English, but not so vulgar in American English. So I really wanted to look at the men other than Bonnie Prince Charlie. I think Bonnie Prince Charlie has had a bad press in many ways, but he's never been my focus, really. I wanted to look at the ordinary men and find out something about them. There's a Glaswegian called Captain Andrew Wood. I have his halfpenny, which he gave to his jailer in Southwark just before he was hanged. He was one of those who was hanged for treason, so he's in there. And I wanted to look at the medical men, because Edinburgh Royal Infirmary had just been built, and there was a lot about prisoners from Preston Pans being in Edinburgh Royal Infirmary. And I wanted also to look at Johnny Cope, as in, you know, the song about Hey Johnny Cope.
Hey Johnny Cope.
Are you walking? Yes. And I read, there was an inquiry afterwards, because it was such a terrible defeat. You know, in Britain, if something, I don't know if the States is the same, but in Britain, if something goes wrong, there's an inquiry and people spend months and nothing really comes out of it. So then I discovered that as they were creeping about before Preston Pans, the dogs in a village had started to bark and howl, and that had upset everybody or alerted everybody. So it was really looking at all these different kind of men, and Duncan Forbes of Culloden, as I say, and some of the men on the other side, of the conflict. There's a lovely man called Donald Roy MacDonald, who was in hiding in the Hebrides for a long time, and he'd been shot through the foot. And it was serious, because it could have gone septic, but it cleared up, and he wrote a poem, an ode to his wounded foot, which is just irresistible.
Talk briefly about some of your fiction.
I started off writing, would you believe it, a great big time slip book, which has not yet seen the light of day, but may do. And then that went to publishers and got what I dubbed rave rejections, which means we love this, but. And they asked me to write books set in my native Glasgow, which we call here family saga books. And I wrote six of those, which were all kind of love stories crossed with social history. The River Flows On was about the building of the Queen Mary back in the 1930s. Well, that was the emotional core, but the story of the people went around it. And then I wrote a book called One Sweet Moment, which is set in 19th century Edinburgh and is about in the vaults. You know, there are a lot of underground vaults in Edinburgh.
Oh, yes. I was finally able to visit one this past year.
Yeah, which were oyster cellars and so on. And Edinburgh is that twin city. It's that new town and old town and dark and light. and goodness on one side and evil on the other side. So that was a most enjoyable book to write. And then the next one is Gathering Storm, which is a Jacobite book, in which it took me a long time to realise that my hero was wearing a red coat. I had to come to terms with the fact that my hero was going to be a red coat and very anti-Jacobite. And of course, he meets a girl who's very pro-Jacobite. So at the moment, I'm writing the sequel to that, which is going to be called Dance to the Storm, and a couple of other non-fiction books in the middle of that as well. A sort of history of Glasgow politics. And I've just written a short biography of a World War I nurse called Henrietta Taylor, who was a Jacobite historian. And I kept tripping over her when I was researching Jacobites and thought, she's interesting, and then found that she'd written a memoir of being a nurse in the First World War. So that's the latest book.
Well, that sounds fascinating, her memoir as well.
Well, she was one of these indomitable women who said what she thought. She was kind, but she said what she thought. And if she saw something needed doing, she would just wade in there and do it.
That kind of sounds like Claire.
Yes, very much so. Very practical. Walk into a ward and see what's needing doing here. Right, do this, do that, I'll do this, that sort of thing.
When you come up on a new project or you have a new idea or you're sitting down to actually start something, how do you approach a new project?
Well, that depends. Often when I'm writing fiction, it starts from a place or a picture. When I started to write Gathering Storm, I had seen a photograph of a man, a modern man, who looked quite sad. And I thought, oh, why do you look so sad? And I didn't really want to know anything about the real man, but I just pinned this up on the computer and just looked at him for a long time and thought, you didn't have a happy childhood, did you? So it's kind of spinning up that sort of the backstory around the person. And then quite often I just sit down and write and see what happens. And I sat down to write about that man, and I found I was in Edinburgh in the 1740s and we were on the track of an illegal dissection. And wrote myself into a corner by about page 60 and then had to go back and plan it a bit. I like instinctive like writing, but sometimes you have to plan a bit. So that's really the approach to fiction. And if I get stuck, I have a few mottos for myself, which is dig deeper. And if you dig deeper under the character's emotions, then that gives you the push to get on to the next scene or the next chapter or whatever.
Fascinating. I always like, no matter whom we have, whether it is actors, writers, producers, bakers, in whatever their art or whatever their profession, I always find it fascinating to see, to get into their craft, to get into their minds and find out more about how they work. Because that, to me, that's something that is not always, that's not in the final product. That is behind the scenes during the production. And I'm a student of, a very amateur student of psychology and just humans in general. I find it fascinating.
I love to read. There's a book called, I think it's called Writing from the Inside Out by a man called Palumbo, I think. And he was a psychoanalyst and a scriptwriter in Hollywood. And that's very interesting about where writing comes from.
Fascinating. So it's about how, like, where it comes from in the psyche?
Where it comes from in the psyche. And he told a story about, is it from Woody Allen, or it's in a Woody Allen movie, about somebody's on a train and it's quite dull. And then another train goes past and there's people drinking cocktails and dancing. But that train goes into the distance. And it's kind of, most people feel they're not on the train with the people having fun. They're on the dull train. So it's all things like that. And how you, the more you try and nail writing down, the more likely it is to run away from you. You have to let it come to you. It's this idea, you know, it's a common, what would you say? It's a common description, might even come from Michelangelo, that the sculpture's there in the stone. You just have to chip away and it'll be cut. And I think stories are like that. I think the stories are waiting to be told. And to a certain extent, although obviously in nonfiction, you're looking for the facts, to a certain extent, they're waiting to be told too. It's just waiting for you to go to the research library and open the box and open that folder and find out something you didn't know you were looking for, but it's there.
Fascinating. Well, Maggie Craig, thank you so much for joining us. Fascinating not only to speak to you, of course, of your book, Damn Rebel Bitches, but to find out more about your process and to find out about your background and see how that led to your path and then your process. Again, I find it fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing that with us and with our listeners. And we hope to have you back. And I'm very interested in a project you're working on about the nurse, the yes. World War I nurse. That I would love to, I can't wait to read it. And I would love to have you back to discuss that.
Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code Outlander20, Outlander20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Outlander Pod.